Amen. Thank you, Paul.
Sure.
Thank you, Paul.
Without anybody.
Sit on the front row and heckle. Yeah, there are other seats, but all right. We are in Song of Songs, and we're about 3 weeks in. I'm a little bit hesitant to ask this question. Probably don't give me a show of hands, and I definitely don't want to know details. But how's it going? How's the romance going? Any romantic gestures? Anything? Any stealing kisses? Sitting a little bit closer together? Anything like that? Remember, that's what we're going for here. Gross the kids out a little bit. Carrie's not here, so I'm seeing some hands. Thank you. We're grossing the kids out. Nice job. Yeah, my oldest caught Carrie and I making out on the couch, and that was awkward this week.
Nice.
It was very.
This open book thing
same.
Is
yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Spread it. We got to be in this room. Talking about Song of Songs, man. You got to be open about stuff. So. It's not too late. Valentine's Day is coming. That's kind of like that goal, right? So have something to look forward to. We are talking about the Song of Songs. If you're new with us, we're talking about Song of Songs maybe a little bit different than you've heard it taught before. The Song of Songs is not a how-to book. It's not a 10 steps to better your marriage that you're going to find in the bookstore. It's a book of poetry. And like poetry, like love poetry or love songs or even romantic movies, we read these, we watch these, we listen to these because it's inviting us to join in. And it's a celebration of what I'll call the emotive side of love. So there's the commitment side of love. There's a lot of other aspects of marriage, of love that we can talk about. But the Song of Songs is specifically a celebration of romance, of passion, of what fuels your love for both that first year and the 10th year and the 20th year and the 60th year that you guys are together. And it may look different when you have been together for some time than when you were newlyweds. But even though it changes, it's still just as necessary. And it's just as beautiful. In fact, maybe more so, you could argue. But you show me two people who are committed, who are determined to stay in that marriage, but without any type of romance or passion, I'll show you two very miserable people. I don't think that's what God's intent is. And that's not what I want. It's not what you want for your marriage. So that's why we're talking about this. This is why I think it's so important, because I think this is how God intends marriage to be done, and we don't always talk about this side of it for a variety of reasons. Now, before we get into today's songs, I do want to address one question that I got last week that I thought was a really good question. In the context of the discussion last week, I was talking about husbands serving their wives as an expression of love. And it was in the context we were talking about sex begins in the kitchen. And in that, I gave an example of serving Carrie, like one way, one expression of serving Carrie is, for example, like doing the dishes. And the question that was posed to me, again, I think it's a really important question, and I think it's one that probably more of us have thought about is, well, shouldn't you be doing the dishes anyway? That's a fair question. That's a great question. They're my dishes. So why should Carrie feel appreciative or, you know, feel more loved by the fact that I'm doing the dishes because I should have just been doing them anyway? It's sort of like, guys, we don't get to call it babysitting when we take care of the kids. There are kids, okay? Got a few amens on that one? So we don't babysit the kids. We parent the kids. We care for the kids because they're our kids. So I think there are a number of layers to this conversation, okay? And I don't have time to unpack all of them. There's a lot of ways that our perspective and our views on gender roles and division of labor have changed and also are different even within this room because of either your perspective or your background or your life situation. So I'm not trying to unpack all of that, but I will say this as I thought about this, and maybe this will be helpful, maybe not, I don't know. But as I was trying to think through this and desperately trying to figure out why doing the dishes actually is something loving that I can do for my wife, it occurred to me a couple of things. One is this: love and duty are not mutually exclusive. And Jesus seems to say something along these lines when he says, if you love me, you'll keep my commands. These are two sides of the same coin, which means that I can do a specific act with two different motivations. So I may do the dishes because it's the right thing to do and because I'm supposed to, but I can also do it because it's an expression of love. And what's interesting here, though, is that Jesus seems to suggest that love is the greater and more powerful motivation. And I think that's really important. Because I think that there are dangers when we get that backwards. I think that there's dangers that happen when we emphasize duty to the exclusion of love or at the expense of love. So let me give you a few of these off the top of my head as I was thinking through this. So one is we start to keep score. Rather than seeking to serve the other person, and that's what we think about as this loving relationship, we're serving one another. When everything that we do is something that we should do, it is a duty, and that's the grid through which I see this, then it's easy for me to start saying, well, you're not doing what you should do, and I am doing what I should do, and so I bathed the kids last night, why aren't you bathing the kids this night? Or I cooked dinner last night, you're not cooking dinner this night, right? So we begin to keep score, and that is not a great way to do marriage, just in case you were wondering. If you were on the edge, like, should I keep score or not? Let me just push you away from that, okay? Okay. Secondly, and this just follows with it, we lose appreciation for our spouses because inevitably their score isn't going to be great. So if we keep score and everything, remember, we're seeing everything through this grid of duty, everything is what they should do, then in a sense, I've set them up to only disappoint me. You can only do what you should have done anyway, and the only option there is, well, you didn't do it. So either I'm like, well, yeah, you did what you should have done, or you've disappointed me. And so I begin to lose it. We lose appreciation for what our spouse does. Last but not least, again, we set up our spouses for failure. Okay, so you just take this along as logical progression. Well, you can only disappoint me. Then if you take that long, far enough and long enough through a marriage, then that person is only a disappointment to you. You've set them up for failure. They, in a sense, you've made it impossible for them to express love to you because you've said whatever they do, they should have done anyway. So I think that, so this is the danger when we overemphasize duty at the expense of exclusion of love. Thank you. Okay. Love is the greater, more powerful motivation. They're not mutually exclusive. And in the marriage relationship, I think it's vital that love is that stronger motivation. And then when I see Carrie's acts of service and the way that she serves me, that I don't go, well, that's what you're supposed to do anyway, and vice versa. Instead, that when she serves me, even though it was in some sense maybe what she should have done, I go, oh, wow, that's incredible that she still does it because, listen, she doesn't have to. Even though it's duty, even though it's responsibility, she doesn't have to do it. And even though those are my dishes, I don't have to do them. So I hope that she realizes that, okay? And so we're motivated by love. And what this means then is the reality is we should serve one another, but we don't always. And so we have to emphasize love. And what that means then is if someone's not doing what they should be doing in the marriage, the way to motivate them isn't to call them to their duty. In case you're wondering. So the stronger and greater power, more powerful motivation is love. And so I actually want to, if I'm trying to, as a husband or a wife, if we're like, okay, you're not coming through with what I need you to do, the better approach then is through love, not through duty. Well, this is what you were supposed to do. You should have done this. Not a good approach. Instead, what we do is we appeal to love. Because that's what we want, really. I mean, you don't want... I said this in the very first week. Ladies, you don't want your husband to buy you nice things or take you out a nice date or do anything around the house out of obligation. Now, maybe you're so desperate, you'd love them to do it for whatever reason, okay? But really, you don't. What you want is for them to say, oh, I love you so much. Of course, I will do this or take you out or make you feel special, whatever that is. That's what we want. I don't want Carrie to serve me out of obligation. Then it's just a job, right? We've then relegated this to a relationship of obligation, contractual obligation. I fulfill my duty, you fulfill yours, and there we go on, okay? So those are just my thoughts. I think that they're not mutually exclusive. And so as best I can, because love is the greater, more powerful motivation, I want to lean into that. And I want to use that as the grid through which I see everything that Carrie does for me. And I hope that that's the grid through which she sees everything that I do for her. And it's in that it becomes this dance, right? It's the relationship of serving one another. Now, granted, if you're not doing it, if it takes two to tango. So if you're both not involved in it, then the whole thing breaks down. But what we're talking about here is the ideal, right? And that's what we're shooting for. So we're not making concessions to the non-ideal. What we're trying to do is paint a picture of what we want in our relationships. John, did you have a comment?
Yeah. I mean, I was just going to say, I think the other part of this is that, you know, I hate to reference the love language book, but it's also one of those things. You know?
Absolutely.
It might be something like, you know, doing the dishes, your spouse is hoping that you're going to help out with household chores, but it might not be something like that. I mean, it might just be the you know, for Lisa, sometimes it's the noticing.
Right.
Appreciation, the word of affirmation, or, you know, I mean, you know what, I realize how much you've done, I want you to take the opportunity tonight as a thank you for, you know, these kinds of things. Or, as I said, I think we all have that mode of expectation, and not necessarily it shouldn't be expectation, it's just, you know, as I said, I think it's just, you just need to know your spouse. That's why the open communication is so important. Because with knowing what they appreciate, you're able to, you know, go deeper and you know, doing something like you go out of your way instead of, if you give her the words of affirmation that she so longs for, but then you go ahead and serve her by, you know, acts of service, then, you know what I mean, it kind of, you also aren't just hitting on the same note every single time.
I think it's a great point that there are things that I am going to do for Carrie that I know speak love to her in a stronger way. And I will say this, I think that everyone has all of the love languages. Some are stronger than others, okay? And so what we do want, to John's point, is to know what those strong love languages are and say, okay, I want to make sure that I'm hitting on this one. But I also recognize, so for me, acts of service actually isn't one of Carrie's love languages. And yet, when I do that, I'm still communicating love to her, and she still appreciates it because of that relationship of love. So it's not that you just get to ignore. In other words, my point is, don't ignore the other ones. Well, that's not hers. That's not his. Don't worry about it. Actually, they all are, and they're all part of that relationship, right? So, yeah.
I think as a wife, like, one of the things I had to learn was to shift my mindset to one of gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and be appreciative of things, like, instead of, like you said, like, not keeping score or having expectations, but just learning how to say thank you for when he did things. And if my mindset was more like, when we first got married, like, you should be mopping the floor too, or whatever. And then as time evolved, I realized, like, I had a bad attitude in my approach with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because instead of me, like you said, approaching him with gratitude when he did something, it was always, you can't quite meet the standard of expectations.
You've either lived up to my expectation.
Right.
Or you've disappointed me.
And then when I shifted to more gratitude and was more thankful, and I still work on that, like, his attitude of whatever he was or wasn't doing was different. And I just saw more of what he was doing.
Yeah.
He was doing a lot of things. Mm-hmm. I just had to choose to see it. And so I think, and I also want to say one thing as women, like, we tend to, like, we'll get mad about what our husband's doing or not doing things, but we also can be overly controlling about what we think should be done or
have. I'm glad you're here to say, I didn't know, I didn't want to say,
And I had a friend of mine that was married like before I ever got married. One of the things she said to me was, choose carefully, like, what you're not going to let him do or have done a certain way, because he'll just stop doing it. And it'll be yours. So decide right now all the stuff that you want to own, because let me tell you, honey, if you give him a hard time, you're going to own it forever.
There you go.
And I really received that. So I would also say, if your husband doesn't do dishes, or when he does, you complain about how he did them.
Yeah.
It's your fault. Sorry.
Yeah. So I mean, what I'm hearing is that you know, listen, guys are fairly simple. We're a lot like puppies. Okay. So yeah, there's a little bit of that positive. Affirmation is actually really helpful. I'm kidding, but there is that, right? So being positive over what we do, just using that is very, very helpful. Okay, we got to keep going. I thought it was a great question, and I really wrestled with it, because I think there is that sense of, okay, but this is your job within the house in both directions, And there's truth in that. Okay, but we don't want it to just become a job. Nobody wants our relationships to be jobs about who's getting what done. And so I think it's a great question. So that's why I brought it up. Okay, the third song. This is from Songs 3, 6 through 5, 1. And again, using some different divisions, using Gordon Johnston's OT scholar, his divisions. We're looking at these different songs within the greater context of the song. All right, so here we go. Who is this coming up from the desert? Like a column of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and incense, made from all the spices of the merchant. Look! It is Solomon's carriage, escorted by 60 warriors, the noblest of Israel, all of them wearing the sword, all experienced in battle, each with his sword at his side, prepared for the terrors of the night. Wow, this is very dramatic, isn't it? So this is from the perspective of someone who's watching this column of this processional, if you will, of Solomon and his warriors, among others, coming towards them across the desert. And so what's happening? What is this scene of? Now, it sounds almost like they're preparing for battle, doesn't it? He's got his warriors, and he's got prepared for the terrors of the night. That sounds pretty intense, but it's not. In fact, if you read on, and we're not going to go there quite yet, you find that it's actually a wedding processional. This is Solomon with his entourage showing up for the wedding. So they look terrifying, but notice they smell really nice. Preferred with myrrh and incense and made from all the spices of the merchants. So it's like, I'm afraid, but oh, wow, that's quite lovely.
You're not going there.
Yeah, yeah. That was a very limited application. It was very, very narrow. So here's what I noticed about this. I wanted to point out about this, and several commentators point out that he's showing up with these warriors. Now, there's a couple of reasons why he does this. One is that Solomon shows up with his warriors because he's letting them know that I'm not to be trifled with. Remember, I'm the king. So look at me in my glory. Look at who I am. And I'm showing up and everyone goes, wow, dang. Okay. But also, he's letting his bride know that she is safe, that he will protect her. There's a deep psychological need that men have to protect the women that they love. And what I find is that it doesn't matter what you look like or how masculine you are. In fact, your wife may be an MMA fighter, and you might look like this. Your wife can be Wonder Woman, and you can look like this. It doesn't matter. You still want to protect your wife. And ladies, if I can be honest, you want your man to protect you. You want your man to make you feel safe and secure. Now, maybe there's one or two of you who don't, but most women, this is a deep psychological desire that you have to be loved and to be cared for, to be protected, even to the point that he would die for you. I mean, that's the greatest expression of love, is it not? That's what Jesus said. And Paul takes that expression and he applies it to the church. Jesus dies for his bride. And in that, he applies it to marriage as well. The husbands, our greatest expression of love is that we look like Jesus and we lay down our lives for our bride, just as Jesus laid down his life for his bride. So there's a deep psychological need, men, that we have to protect our wives. It's hardwired into us. And this is one of the ways that we imitate Christ. We look like him. Now, what that doesn't mean is that manliness, to be masculine, does not necessarily look like this. Okay, this is if you've heard this, that this is what it means to be a man, you've got a raw deal, okay? And sometimes we hear this kind of, by the way, did you know that Chuck Norris, when he turned 18, his parents moved out? Chuck Norris once drew his gun and killed 500 men, and then he started shooting. Chuck Norris once counted to infinity, and then he did it again. Chuck Norris tells Simon what to do. I can keep going. There is no theory of evolution, just a list of animals that Chuck Norris allows to live.
He's from Dallas, by the way.
He is.
Yeah.
A cobra once bit Chuck Norris. After 5 excruciating days of pain, the cobra died. All right. So this is not a picture of biblical masculinity. This is not what it looks like to be. You're welcome. This is not what it looks like to be a man, all right? This is what it looks like to be a man. And so, guys, you may have grown up, I don't know what your background was, you may have grown up with very few positive male role models. Maybe your dad was absent, or maybe he was a terrible picture for you, but this you can keep looking at. This man is worth imitating. And the way that he expresses, right, what it means to be a man is that he lays down his life for his bride to the point of death. And so my privilege then, my calling, my responsibility, but my privilege as Carrie's husband is that I get to lay down my life for her. I get to protect her. And when the Apostle Paul writes about, and if you take this over to Ephesians 5, and he describes this relationship, the husband leads his wife, but he does so through self-sacrifice, through protection. So that, notice the language, and we're not looking at it, but just remember the language, so that she looks radiant and beautiful. See, my job is to protect Carrie, to lead her to Christ, and to protect her from anything that would harm her, and anything that would prevent her from becoming as radiant, as beautiful as God desires. And so Carrie, in that sense, I mean, she wants me to protect her. And then she desires for me to do that, because if that's your definition of protection, it doesn't mean that I'm her boss. It doesn't mean that I make all the decisions. But if that's your definition of protection, of being led sacrificially through unconditional love, that she becomes more radiant, more beautiful, more amazing, which is a tall order for me because she's pretty much right there. But I'm going to do my best, right? Then who wouldn't want that? I think that we have to acknowledge that there's a lot of harm that's been done in terms of how we understand marriage. And guys, we have to own the fact that we get this wrong all the time, okay? And we do take what God intends in terms of our relationship, and we turn it into, well, now I am the boss, and I am making all the decisions. And it's been misunderstood and misapplied this way. It's been perverted, and it's been abused. But can I just say that this is not a reason to throw the baby out with the bathwater, okay? Just because there are parents who've done terrible things in the name of disciplining their kids, that doesn't mean that we should stop disciplining our kids. That is an unloving and irresponsible thing to do to our children. And so husbands, it is an unloving and irresponsible thing for you to do to no longer be the husband, to be who God has called you to be in that relationship, to protect your wife, to love her so that in such a way that she looks more like Jesus, she becomes more radiant and more beautiful. And I don't know a woman who doesn't want that. So ladies, listen, your husband, he wants to protect you. He wants you to look at him like he's Superman, okay? Even if the closest he ever comes is wearing Superman undies. Not knocking that, by the way. Okay? He wants you to look at him that way. Really? That was the one that got you? Okay.
And you're getting on to me.
We'll compare notes next week. I think we just make a good team, Paul. That's really what it is. You set it up, and then I... Anyway, all right. So, ladies, that's what he wants. That's what he wants. He wants to protect you, so let him. Let him. And guys, listen. Your wife wants you to protect her. And she may not say that, ladies, this does not mean that you're not strong. I'm married to an incredibly courageous and strong woman. In no way does she need me, okay? She could totally knock life out of the park on her own, okay? She can handle it. She can handle all of it. And yet, there's a sense in which she needs me. And the same way, I mean, I can handle life. I can do everything that has, right? I'm a capable, intelligent person. She is a capable, intelligent person. We can do that. And yet, we need one another. And she needs me to protect her, and she wants me to protect her. And so, guys, your wives, they want you to protect them. And they may not say it, but they want you to be strong. They want you to protect. They want you to lead. They want you to do that, but you got to do it the right way. Otherwise, the whole thing falls apart. Again, this is what we said earlier. It takes two to tango, right? This is a dance. And so if you have a wrong perspective of what it means to lovingly lead your wife and to protect her and to lay your life down for her, then yeah, no kidding, she doesn't respond to that very well. So the onus is on us. We have to do it well. Okay. Got to keep going here because I'm going to run out of time. Verse 9, King Solomon made for himself the carriage. He made it of wood from Lebanon, its posts he made of silver, its base of gold. Its seat was upholstered with purple, its interior lovingly inlaid by the daughters of Jerusalem. Come out, you daughters of Zion, and look at King Solomon wearing the crown. Look at the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day his heart rejoiced. So remember, here's the processional, and it's got all these guys decked out, and they look awesome. And here's, and it smells good. And here comes Solomon, and he's in like the nicest carriage. Beautiful wood and precious jewels, and he's wearing this crown. He looks his best. In other words, this guy is making an entrance. Everybody in the village or the city or whatever is like, wow, look at this guy. So let's be honest for a second. As the longer you're married, the more difficult it is to catch your spouse's eye, to get their attention. And we also kind of quit trying as hard too, right? Because we kind of have them. See, when you're first dating, it's like, okay, I'm going to put on my best. And guys, we actually put on clean clothes and we shower and smell nice. Right, because we want her to choose us. We want them to think, wow, they're really special. I wanted Carrie to think that I was special so that she would choose me. But then after you get married, well, you're stuck with me. So I don't have to try so hard. You're not going anywhere, theoretically. What was I going to say about this? Oh, yeah. Carrie told me to tell you. I mentioned before that Carrie buys all of my clothes. I don't let Carrie buy my clothes. She buys my clothes, whether I want her to or not. This has nothing to do with me, okay? So she buys my clothes. And she wanted me to let you know that while she approves of every article that I'm wearing today, this was not a combination that she was totally in favor of. So there's a few ladies nodding their heads like, yeah, that wasn't it. I had to go, all right? So I was just... All the guys are like, what's wrong with it? Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. So notice this. When you're dating, okay, here's why this matters. When you're dating, you're trying to make the other person think that you're special. After you're together, you know why you dress up? You know why you go out? You know why you look like Solomon and you get, put on the show and make an entrance? So that she knows she's special. You see the difference? See, when you're dating, it's all about, I want her to think I'm special so that she'll choose me. Now, there are times when I have to get dressed up, and it's hard for me. It's not my thing. T-shirt, shorts, and flip-flops, man. But there are times when I need to look nice, and I need to take Carrie out to a fancy dinner, not so that she thinks I'm special, but so that she knows she's special. So let me give you a really cheesy movie clip to show you what I mean. We'll see if it plays the first time. Nope. This is how you make an entrance. I love it when you sing to me. Oh, Rick and you. You can sing me anything. There's a lot going on in this clip, by the way.
Why aren't you at the party?
Oh, because it's a dance, and to dance you need a partner. My partner is right here.
Oh.
Beverly, dance with me.
I don't know how.
Yeah, you do.
No,
you've been dancing with me for 19 years.
I don't know the steps.
I'll teach you.
Here.
I love it when you give me things.
Okay. Now, lots going on in that clip, actually. So notice, he shows up looking great because he's letting her know that she's special. And notice the friends are all like, dang, that woman married well, right? But also, here's the turnabout. She thinks he's pretty special because of how he made her feel. So a lot of what I'm covering today, I feel like I'm, and maybe this is because I am the husband, but husband, making your wife feel special is one way that she knows that she chose the right person. And she goes, oh yeah, I am lucky. And then she thinks you're pretty special because of how you made her feel. It's worth the investment. All right. How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes behind your veils are doves. Your hair is like a flock of goats descending from Mount Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep just shorn, coming up from the washing. Each has its twin. Not one of them is alone. Your lips are like a scarlet ribbon. Your mouth is lovely. Your temples behind your veil are like the halves of a pomegranate. Probably not the language that we would use. Hey. Honey, you have all your teeth. You're so beautiful. And they match. Your hair is like a flock of goats. Probably don't try that one. So commentators have often speculated, and they said, well, this is the wedding night. This is when they're alone in a room, but probably not. This was part of the ancient Near Eastern custom for the groom to lead the bride out into the middle of everyone and to praise her beauty, all of her. This is tame. Okay. Now, just for fun, just imagine this for a second, that you are at your wedding. And so ladies, you're led out in the middle of the dance floor, and your just now husband walks around you praising your beauty. And so now, on the one hand, you're thinking, this is terrifying and embarrassing and really awkward. You're glad. How many of you are glad we don't do this? And yeah, a lot of hands. Okay. Janae's like, I would totally be down for that. But think about it. So a lot of ladies like, I don't want to do that. But think about the pressure on the guy. He's got a night ahead of him. There's a lot riding on this. I mean, you better nail this, right? Otherwise, that's going to be a long night. Okay, moving on. Your neck, see, it's just getting started. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with elegance. On it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. Your two breasts are like two fawns, like twin fawns of a gazelle that browse among the lilies. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee, I will go to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of incense. All beautiful are you, my darling. There is no flaw in you. And so he's actually being complimentary. I know the language sounds really crazy to us, but he's actually saying, you are beautiful. But notice that this is a very contextualized description. So beauty has changed throughout the centuries. You know that, right? So standards of beauty have changed. In fact, if we were to take this literally, somebody did a picture. Not good.
That is awesome.
That is, yeah. Woo, she's hot. No, it's hideous, okay? So standards of beauty have changed. But not only that, in fact, here's another, somebody else drew this one much later. All right, but for every person, by the way, every guy, you have a different standard of beauty. And by the way, your standard of beauty is your wife. So the standard of beauty may be changing all around us even today. I mean, from 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years, 100 years ago, thousands of years ago, clearly it's changed. But yours actually is set. And it's your wife. So here's mine. Here's my standard of beauty. She's pretty hot, isn't she? All right. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Descend from the crest of Amna. From the top of Sinir, the summit of Hemron, from the lion's dens and the mountain haunts of the leopards. I think he's saying, come out of my in-laws' homes. That's how I interpret this. I don't think that's that. You have stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. You have stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one glance of your necklace. So this is the language here. You've stolen my heart. The in the Hebrew, this is not a literal translation. It's we don't have the words for it. It's a very robust expression, but it has to do with, like, I'm seeing you, and it's like you've robbed me of my senses. I can't think straight, but also I'm changed. Okay, I'm not who I was because I've seen you. So let me give you, I want to give you a picture of this as well. I want to give you two pictures of this, and you'll see why.
Excuse me. A thousand apologies, Your Royal Highness. I don't know what happened.
That's quite the bow.
If I may, that is, it would give me the greatest pleasure if you would do me the honor of letting me lead you through this, the first.
Dance.
Yes, dance. That's it.
Okay, so this is a picture of young love. He sees her. What does it say? You've stolen my heart. He's robbed of his senses. He doesn't remember the word dance. He sees her, and he will never forget that moment where she appears so radiant. Now, here's the problem with moments like that. They only happen once. And the first time, hopefully you remember, that first time that you saw your spouse and it hit you. But it only happens once. I remember the first time I really saw Carrie. I'd known her for years, but then I saw her, and I was like, okay, game changer right here. I remember the first time that I saw Carrie when the doors opened at the back of the church and she was in her wedding dress. We don't get to relive those. Okay, so in those moments, she steals my heart, and she changes me, in a sense. But let me show you another picture of the same thing, okay, from a different time of life.
Our vows?
Yeah.
I wonder if they still hold up.
Rebecca,
saying I do means saying I will. I will love you today and every day for the rest of my life.
All right, what do you got?
A coin.
Nice. It's perfect. I love that. Okay, put that in.
I've been trying to focus on all of the little moments that I don't want to forget. But the moment that has burned into my brain and heart was the first time I saw you. Rebecca, you have changed the way I think about love.
Is this, And you'll just have to, I won't explain the movie clip to you. It was to make this point, though. It wasn't a movie, it was a TV show, but anyway. I'll put it on the video, so when you if you watch it later, we'll embed it and then you can see it, okay? Those moments only happen once. And when you get older, those moments get further and further away. But one of the really beautiful things about memory is how powerful it is. And so I remember when I saw Carrie for the first time, really saw her. I remember our wedding day. I remember those moments along the way. And because they're memory and they're embedded in my mind, we can replay them over and over and over again. And memory is so powerful that as you do that, you actually remember smells and tastes, and you remember how you felt about that other person. And so marriage counselors will tell you that one of the most powerful ways that you can rekindle or kindle romance in your relationship is to replay those moments together. It's that conversation that you have where, I remember when I first saw you. I remember when you looked like this. I remember on our wedding day when the doors opened and you stood there in your wedding dress. I remember when you stole my heart. So we can't go back. We're not going back to the first time that we met. Been there, done that. But there's something incredibly beautiful as you walk through life and you kindle romance by remembering and sharing those memories with each other over and over and over again. So, there you go. If you're not feeling as in love with your spouse, man, read your vows together, right? Talk about that first time you met. Talk about memories that you have. And it's remarkable what that can do. All right. Closing up here, home stretch. How delightful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much more pleasing is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your perfume than any spice. Your lips drop sweetness as the honeycomb, my bride. The milk and honey are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like that of Lebanon. You are a garden locked up, my sister, my bride. You are a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain. Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates, with choice fruits, with henna and nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with every kind of incense tree, with myrrh and aloes and all the finest spices. You are a garden fountain, a well of flowing water streaming down from Lebanon. In other words, what he's saying is, you are my private paradise. You are my private garden. You are so beautiful. And if you actually go back several verses, back to verse 9, you'll find a pattern here where he says, you look amazing, you taste amazing, and you smell amazing. In other words, for him, she is beauty incarnate. She is the whole package. And now she makes the invitation. Awake, north wind, and come, south wind. Blow on my garden that its fragrance may spread abroad. Let my lover come into his garden and taste its choice fruits. She has been loved. She feels special. She feels special. And so she says, let my lover come into his garden and taste his choice fruits. What's on the menu? She says, I am. And then we have a gap here. We don't see anything. And he says, I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I've gathered my myrrh with my spice. I've eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I've drunk my wine and my milk. In other words, you tasted really good. And then he says, eat, O friends, and drink. Drink your fill, O lovers. It's almost as though he's expressing something. Maybe you've thought of this before. When you're with your spouse and you think, I hope someone has experienced love the way that we do. Because it's so intense and it's so beautiful and it's so amazing. And you think, in one sense, you think, I don't think anyone could love the way that we love. And another part of you thinks, I hope no one does. But then there's this other part that goes, man, I hope that other people could have what we have. And that's what he's doing. He's expressing this to all the readers. I hope that you have what we have. I hope you have this type of relationship. I hope you have this kind of intimacy. And so he closes by wishing everyone to have found what he's found in his beloved. All right, as we wrap up, here's a homework for this week, and I said this before, it's really aimed at the husbands, and it's to make your wife feel special. What does that look like for her? You know, go back to the love languages, but also, what does it look like to make her feel special in the midst of life that often tells you you're not very special? and you often don't feel very special. So guys, this is an opportunity, the privilege that we have to make our wives feel special, and then she will look at you and she'll think, he's pretty special too. She will feel like the luckiest woman in the world if you make her feel special, especially when everything around her is telling her the opposite. There's so much pressure in the world today, whether it's your physical appearance or how you parent as a mom or how you do your job or how you balance work and life and all of this, and you get on social media and it's like everything tells you how you're not doing as well, good a job as anyone else, how you're not measuring up. And I know that wives live with that pressure all the time. And so, husbands, this is our moment to say, no, you are so special. You have no idea. All right. That's the challenge. That's your privilege. Have fun with it.